Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
One of the movies that is out this week, which is getting an awful lot of attention, is Mad Hot Ballroom. We'll talk to one of its stars in just a moment. Just give us the premise of it, Mark, because this is being described, you know, if you liked Spellbound, if you liked Etrennes et Avoir and those kind of films, that you'll like this. So tell us about Mad Hot Ballroom, then we'll talk to Pierre Dulaine as well.
It's a documentary, and it played at the London Children's Film Festival, of which both you and I are both patrons. And it's
you gesticulated to Bill as opposed to me then.
Yes, you're not a patron, yeah. Because frankly, who would want you?
That would have confused us.
Okay, which Bill and I are both patrons. It's a documentary about young kids in New York from often very, very challenging backgrounds who learn ballroom dancing, and they then compete in this large ballroom dancing competition. And extraordinarily, although it's not, you know, one of those tales in which obviously all the people you expect to win, what does happen is that a lot of the children who have sort of social problems to some extent overcome their problems through learning about ballroom dancing. And the greatest indication of its enjoyment factor is my 7-year-old saw it and danced pretty much all the way through the movie, and now has decided that she actually now wants to take up ballroom dancing. So it's, you know, it's a lovely, uplifting documentary, which I believe they are now thinking about turning into a feature film, although I'm not entirely sure that that's a good idea.
Well, one of its stars is dance teacher Pierre Dulaine, who joins us. Hello, Pierre.
Hello, good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay, what do you think of Mark's description? Did that work for you?
It works for me, yes. Our program really takes ballroom dancing to the 10, 9, 10, 11-year-olds in New York City. And it's been most, most successful. And, of course, the documentary was made on our program, which is called Dancing Classrooms. But the effect is really incredible with these children. I mean, we teach them the steps, yes, but so many more things come out for the children.
And you're one of their teachers?
No, I am, but I'm not anymore. I am the director. I'm the one who started this program 12 years ago with one school in New York City. And now we have over 40 teachers working for us, and we're going to 114 schools. So we've really gone up in numbers.
How are the schools and the particular children involved chosen?
Well, actually, we are a not-for-profit organization in New York City, which means we can ask people for money. It's like we are a charity organization. We go to the schools that really want us. And in New York City, there are 5 different boroughs, and so we go to all of them. And we just teach the what we call 4th grade and 5th graders. That's year 4, year 5. And we have a 10-week course. And this is why at the time of the documentary, we were in 60 schools, 10 weeks, and one winner at the end. And so the culminating event of our program is a competition that we call a team match, mm-hmm. The Colors of the Rainbow team match. And this school, am I allowed to say which school wins?
Sure. It's your film.
Well, no, for people listening. Anyway, this one school, we had three schools were chosen for the documentary. And one of them was from Washington Heights in the northern part of New York City, and where the kids really come with challenges. Some of them don't have, you know, 2 parents at home, and quite a lot of problem area. And so this really, what turned them on was being able to dance the various dances from different countries, and somehow having the ability to show their talents to other people and eventually come out as the winners. This is what really is incredible about it.
Now, image is, of course, very important, Pierre, particularly at the sensitive age in which you're dealing with. And there may have been some of the boys that you're dealing with who I would imagine might have thought, I'm not going to do this kind of dancing. It's for softies.
Yes, correctly so. Our program is not an elective, what is known as an elective program. It is part of the school day. It is part of the curriculum, the school curriculum. So we are an arts and education program, which means the whole class must go en masse. And so, I don't really like it, but I have to go. The whole class is going. There's no option. And some of the boys, we call them ladies and gentlemen. We never call them boys and girls, so they can use their imagination. And after 2 or 3 lessons, they really get into it. It's not so bad dancing with a girl. So, and vice versa for the girls, dancing with a boy. So it works out very nicely, for sure.
We're talking movies. Mark Kermode is here, and Pierre Dulaine, who's starring in the Mad Hot Ballroom documentary, which has this got a big release, Pierre? I mean, is this going to be available for everyone to go and see it, or is it just sort of small selected cinemas?
Oh no, I think it is not only in art houses, it is in the major movie houses, movie cinemas, I should say, you know, in England. And so it is a major release, as far as I know, in England, yes.
And you started...
I
was just going to say, you started dancing in Birmingham, didn't you? I mean, you have an interesting history yourself. You're half Palestinian.
That's right.
But you started dancing in Birmingham and you live in New York.
That's right. When I was 14, I had a half tooth on my front teeth. I was very shy, very timid. And I took up ballroom dancing. And it made me, you know, what I am now, let's say, very confident. And I don't mind my accent at all. And I've been living in New York City for the past 30 years. And when this came out, I thought, well, it would be very good for me to come back to England. Mm. And this is where I am right now. It's just for this weekend. I will go back to New York on Sunday or Monday.
Just one point, and then Mark Kermode will have a couple of points to make, doubtless. I just wonder, I imagine most of the children that you were teaching, Pierre, would have been into rap and hip-hop and so on. In certain images of that style of music, women are not particularly treated very well.
Correct.
There are derogatory terms used which we don't need to repeat. Now,
Correct. In
ballroom dancing, it's the reverse. It's almost in an old-fashioned way that the woman needs to be looked after and treated with great respect. How did they take to that?
Well, you have to imagine, have to remember that this is very, very foreign to them. And we call them ladies and gentlemen. We ask them to use their imagination. And they love using... Kids at that age are very impressionable. They love to use their imagination. Just becoming ladies and gentlemen or looking elegant. Everybody wants dreams of being elegant. And we ask the gentlemen to ask the ladies, may I have this dance, please? And ladies have to say, with pleasure. They have to learn how to shake hands with each other, look at each other, I make eye contact, etc. These things are novel to them. And they experiment with them, and then the dancing really becomes secondary. But at the same time, there's a lot of fun that comes along with the dancers by moving your body and smiling and shaking and laughing. You let go of all of these inhibitions that you have, and you stop thinking about it. You just get on with it. And because my friends are having to do it, I will do it as well. And we all have a good fun, a good time at the end. It's really interesting.
Whilst the kids, the younger members of the audience, I think, can enjoy watching the other kids dancing, just because that's inspirational. I wonder if you just say something about, I mean, my impression watching it was that the most important thing that was going on was almost not the kids learning to dance. It was what them learning to dance was teaching them about other ways of dealing with, you know, with the life problems that they were faced with. There is one particular young kid who we are told at one point, if it hadn't been for him learning ballroom dancing, one of his teachers says, well, you know, he could have ended up a criminal, he could have ended up in jail, and she thinks that this is a very likely thing that would have happened.
Yes, exactly. Well, the thing is, children of that age, of any age, act up because they're not getting attention. They're not getting personal attention. But classroom teachers in any schools with 30, 31 kids in a class, it's very hard for them to pay attention, individual attention to every one of them. And they end up falling behind. Now, they come to do ballroom dancing, and wow, with this music, suddenly they find they can excel in this. Something can, wow, I can do this. And not every child is going to become a doctor or a solicitor or a dentist. So if they find they can excel in one thing, wow, it gives them the confidence, then suddenly you'll find out that their marks in the classwork become better. So it really does take a different dimension once they excel at one thing.
And how much do you think the success of this, both in America where it has taken a large amount of money and here where it looks set to do so, has been influenced by the success of Spellbound? Because Spellbound caught everybody off guard. No, I mean, I know Etre Avoir had made some headway, but nobody expected that a movie about kids doing a spelling bee competition could win hearts in the way that it did. And I wonder whether that's affected the success of Mad Hot Ballroom.
I honestly cannot tell you that. I'm not from the executive world of filmmaking, so I really don't know. But I do know now that, you know, coming from show business, that, you know, it's to follow kids and animals is very, very hard. So anything with kids and music and movement, it can relate to grandparents, to parents and children alike. And I think this is what's been so successful about it.
Pierre, nice to talk to you. And it sounds like you've got a big hit film on your hands.
You're very kind. Thank you very much.
Pierre Delane, who you can see in Mad Hot ballroom. Who do you think that will appeal to specifically?
Well, it's really interesting.
Because bear in mind, you know, the whole world seems to have gone ballroom crazy.
I know. No, it's really interesting. I mean, I did take my 7-year-old to see it because I wondered whether or not it was a film that would appeal to adults. I mean, I'm, you know, an old fart, obviously, and I thought it was very interesting from a kind of social point of view because there are problems that these kids are dealing with. My 7-year-old just thought it was a bunch of kids dancing, and I think, like many kids, would think, you know, wow, that's just, you know, that's fun, and I would like to do that. And it is interesting that it played at the London Children's Film Festival, which, you know, is specifically aimed at a younger audience. I think, you know, the natural point of comparison is actually Spellbound. I mean, Spellbound is a very, very high watermark to match, and I think that nothing does. I mean, Spellbound was so completely left field. You know, who on earth knew that you could make a documentary about spelling bees and have it every bit as nail-biting as a Hitchcock movie, which it really, really was. But I think the thing about Mad Hot Ballroom, it is uplifting and it is heartfelt and it is sweet. You know, it's a bit ragged around the edges. But I watched it and my daughter watched it and we both liked it. The only note I would give you there is that my 4-year-old fell asleep, but then he's a boy and he's young.
Do you think we can do the box office top 10 before the...
It's your show. I do what I'm told.
I'm all indecisive. Let's do it. Let's see if we can fit it in. At box office top 10 this week, Legend of Zorro at 10.
You didn't need a sequel to a remake, so we could do without it.
Brothers Grimm at 9.
The least Gilliam-esque of his movies. I think we've covered that in some depth, but I'm right and Terry's wrong. Sorry.
The Libertine, this week's number 8.
Starts off with about 20 minutes of good stuff, and then that's enough syphilis Ed for about an hour.
Yeah. Saw 2 at 7.
It's every bit as nasty as Saw 1 and then some, and there were at least 3 moments in it in which I reached for the vom bag, which I think is a good thing.
Kiss...
No, it's not. Yes, it is.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang at number 6.
Completely flippant and empty, but a great pair of performances from Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer, both of whom have been insufferable in the past and are here very, very well cast.
Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, number 5.
There's some discussion on the website about whether this has officially flopped in America. Amazingly, Katzenberg is now saying that it has underperformed in the States despite taking $75, $80 million. Apparently, they had higher ambitions for it. I still think that constitutes a success, but apparently not the ambitions that they had for it in America. Over here, a runaway hit, and it's perfect. And if the Americans don't get it, at least some of the Americans don't get it. I mean, hey, I'd like to have a flop that took in $75 million.
Yeah. Maybe that's Katzenberg thinking they didn't take any of my advice.
Oh, yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. That is exactly what it is. Well pointed
out. If only they'd listened to me.
Exactly, it's the revenge of the executive. Yeah, you see, he could have taken 120 if he'd taken out the joke about the marrow.
Nanny McPhee, this week's number 4.
A user significant movie that starts with a joke about cannibalism and is, you know, really, really good fun. It's not quite in the same bracket as Matilda, which I think is a great, you know, comparison point, but it's getting that way and the kids will love it. Kids will laugh all the way through it.
Number 3, The Constant Gardener.
Worthy and Rachel Weisz is great and it's trying to do something ambitious and it should be applauded for that, but it's not the masterpiece that everyone says. If you love The English Patient, apart from you being wrong, you will love this, but it's in the same...
Wasn't she in The Mummy?
Yes, she was.
Was she better in The Mummy?
I think she's a great actress. She's a classic great actress who can do B-movie and can do A-movie. I mean, that's what she does. She's a really, really good actress.
Number 2, In Her Shoes.
I mean, words fail me. How on earth...
They have never failed.
No, but how the director of, you know, L.A. Confidential, and Toni Collette, who's great, and Cameron Diaz, who's okay, and, you know, all put together, and Shirley MacLaine. I mean, I love Shirley MacLaine. I hate this film. It's horrible. Even thinking about it gives me a headache.
You went very camp for a moment there.
Well, it's possible to talk about Shirley MacLaine without going a little bit.
And the UK's number 1, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. No surprise.
It's not as good as Prisoner of Azkaban, but it is good. It is dark. It is too dark for some younger kids. I do stress this. I know everyone's going to see it. But believe me, if you have kids under the age of 8, be prepared to take them crying out of the cinema at certain moments.
Reviews to come of Mrs. Henderson Presents Everything is Illuminated and Flight Plan. And there's loads of emails to get through, and yours welcome, mayo@bbc.co.uk, 85058. It's 5 Live at 3:32. This from Michael says, now that this is, it says, Dear Mark and Mayo, which I'm not quite sure I approve of that sort of term of address, now that you've a new category film, this started last week, called Hum, could you have a new rating called Ho Hum? And then you could have a Ho Hum Hum movie. And now, could I also say that Mark should stop saying ho and indeed hum, because it's getting irritating.
Is it? I thought it was irritating the first time.
Incidentally, is Tim Burton really Timothy Spall in a big black wig? It certainly looks like it from here.
Okay, I think if that's the case, then the aspect ratio on your television is on the wrong mode. You're watching in 16:9 when you should be watching in 4:3.
Is that right?
It makes people look wider than they are.
Lewis in Japan says, Simon, I just thought I'd let you know that I'm very thankful now that Mark's reviews are now downloadable. I was trying to plan a lesson for my EFL students, which I imagine is English as a foreign language. This is last week on the topic of films, and I was struggling. Then I remembered Mark on Five Live and was saved. His ranting saved my lesson, and the students loved it. I've even attached the worksheet, which I used as evidence. I was just sorry that I missed out on the Star Wars rant. That would have had mileage in it for an entire course. If I've infringed copyright by using his rant in a lesson, please call me anonymous. Otherwise, I'm Lewis in Japan. I think that's absolutely fine.
They don't have copyright in Japan anyway, do they? There's certain territories in that area in which copyright is a fictional thing.
Well, anyway, all these reviews are there and they're all downloadable. Just go to the BBC website and you can carry around, Mark in your back pocket for as long as you fancy, really. Amongst the movies that are big this week, you had Dame Judi Dench on the programme a few days ago.
Well,
let's start there. Mrs. Henderson Presents.
Mrs. Henderson Presents, the true, large inverted commas story of the Grand Dame of British Vaudeville Theatre, who, after the death of her husband, took over the running of the Windmill Theatre and took on a manager, Mr. Van Dam, played here by Bob Hoskins. Using a posh accent. Bob Hoskins' accents always sound like Bob Hoskins doing an accent. When he does Bob Hoskins, it's good to talk. You know, that's Bob Hoskins. When he does an American, like in Roger Rabbit, it goes like that. And that's Bob Hoskins. And now he does posh, which is a little bit like that, but it's basically Bob Hoskins doing a posh accent. So very early on, after having taken over the Windmill Theatre, she discovers that there ain't no money in just putting on ordinary clothes and they need to source things up somewhat. See, as you can hear from that, it is a sort of, how many yards of Judi Dench would you like? I mean, it is that performance. You know, Judy, we'd like you to do that thing you do, slightly cantankerous, rather, you know, upper class, incredibly lovable, and obviously about to win an award. And that's what she does. And now, it's directed by Stephen Frears, who on his CV has things like Dirty Pretty Things, which, you know, was great. High Fidelity, The Grifters, Dangerous Liaisons. I mean, he is a director with form. Who, you know, he's actually done proper stuff. None of that is evident here. The word for Miss Henderson Presents is quaint and then some. You know, it's absolutely populated by English types, gels, and people doing marvellously and having tea and scones. And, you know, gosh, there's a war on. But I tell you what, if we just take our clothes off and dance around the stage, everything will be absolutely tipping.
I thought they couldn't dance around the stage. That was the whole point. They have to stand still.
No, they have to stand still at the point at which they take their clothes off, but everybody else can dance. And this is a very, very important thing, because the best performance in the film is the Lord Chamberlain, played by Christopher Guest. Now, of course, to the Spinal Tap fans amongst us, we will know Christopher Guest as the guitarist in Spinal Tap.
And Mighty Wind and
Nigel,
Best
yeah.
in Show. And...
No, he's the key behind all those, but he is Nigel Tufnell. And, of course, I think, now, I always get this wrong, but he is, in fact, some kind of British lord, isn't he? He's like Lord...
And married to Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, but I don't think that there's a title in that. I think that's
She's, you know, lady.
Well, she would be now, yes, but he didn't become that because he... What I'm saying is that his ancestry is British aristocracy. Her ancestry is Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh. So that's a whole other thing, right?
Yes.
Fine. Okay, so anyway, he plays the Lord Chamberlain, who does, in fact, talk like this in an extremely strange way and points out to Mrs. Henderson that it can't possibly have nudity on the British stage. And then she does the duty. Oh, don't be so silly, Tommy. What if they all stand still? It'll be art. And then he says, oh, well, maybe that'll be... And fine, okay? And then they all sing songs, and then the war rages outside. Now... The scenes of the outside of, you know, London suffering from the war do look like outtakes from Mary Poppins with the lights turned down very slightly. The scenes in which Judi Dench and Bob Hoskins dance on the roof of the Windmill Theatre whilst the Luftwaffe strafe London are just, you know, picturesque in a sort of, you know, it's awfully hard being in the war, but it's also rather nice. And my problem with it is, yes, there are many lines that Judi Dench has that are funny. And because she's funny, you know, she is just funny and she delivers in that way that Judi Dench does. And yes, there is a certain kind of quaint British charm to it all. But in the end, quaintness can become rather tiresome. And it doesn't really have the gumption to get to grips with its subject matter. I mean, for example, the Windmill Theatre, you know, what then happened to the Windmill Theatre, which you rather charmingly described the other day as a laptop club.
Yes, I was wondering if you might mention that.
Well, but it's nice that that's how you would think of it. It has a lovely naive innocence that it's one of those laptops. Yes. You and the Lord Chamberlain will get on really marvellously. I say, Your Honour, I've heard about these laptop clubs. As long as they don't move the laptops, that's perfectly fine. So it is all a little bit like that. And if we could just stop for tea and tiffin, everything would get better.
I think that was a nice world. wasn't it?
It was, although, of course...
Apart from the Luftwaffe.
Apart from the, you know, the war
and
the poverty. And what do the Romans ever do for us? I mean, it really is that level. And funnily enough, although it's a British film with a big B, it's clearly made for the export market. It's the kind of thing that the Americans will just, you know, they'll love. I mean, they'll be surprised that we were involved in the Second World War because, as you know,
a bit of a shock to
they
them.
Won it single-handedly after they'd had breakfast for 2 years. But so that will probably show, but it will be one of those films that they take to their heart. And there is a strange brand of British out-of-period costume comedy, you know, in which it's okay, the nudity is... And I was surprised that it's a 12 certificate. The BBFC certificate says contains moderate sex references and one use of strong language. Well, the moderate sex references is basically everyone taking their clothes off, including Bob, which cues a gag, which I'm not going to repeat here, but although I should be able to because it's a 12A, which means that anybody... I mean, I personally wondered at the censor's judgment at passing that film in a 12A because I would... I don't entirely... I mean, maybe I'm just old and cranky, but, I mean, I thought it was clearly a 15-certificate movie, and obviously when I was younger, it would have been an X-certificate movie, because that's the way it is, but the world has changed. I understand that things have moved on. Am I entirely happy about that? Not really. Did I think it was an entirely funny comedy? Not really. Did I think it had any realism about it? Not at all. Did I like the CGI backgrounds? Not in the slightest bit. Did I wish Bob Hoskins would stop talking? Yes. Is it okay?
I'll just write that one down.
Okay.
I love that. You personified there. Loads of correspondents do this.
They are.
They kind of interview themselves, which is great, because you often hear that even the really famous correspondents...
You've got a sore throat!
They're on the 10 o'clock news. You know, they go over to them and they say, I'm here in a very dangerous place. Why? Because these dangerous things are happening. Why are they happening? Well, let me tell you. So there's no need for a presenter, because there's no need for someone to ask the questions, because they ask the questions themselves.
Yes.
That was very good.
Imagine how much fun I am to spend an evening with.
Absolutely. Now, Will Young's in it. And,
yes. He keeps his clothes on.
No, he doesn't.
He does.
He doesn't. I was doing an interview with him yesterday, and he said he takes them off.
Well, I don't remember that happening.
And he enjoyed it very much.
I don't remember a moment with it. There
you
is
never
a moment.
Saw it. No,
excuse me.
You didn't see
no,
the
don't
film.
You dare. You can say anything, but don't you dare say that. There is a moment in which they're trying to get the girls to used to doing it, and people all strip. And there is a moment in which Bob Hoskins is seen in the buff, and Judi Dench makes a joke referring to it. Now, I don't remember, but it may just be that, hey, that's not the way my particular interest is. I don't remember in the midst of the naked people there that one of them was Will Young. The only thing I remember about Will Young's performance in it is that there's a gag in which Judi Dench says, Mr. Blah, or insert whatever character name he plays, do you find any of these ladies attractive? And he says, my inclinations are not that way attuned. And the whole audience goes, oh, cheeky, cheeky. And then I don't remember him for the rest. He wears a flat cap.
And nothing else. But
no,
you obviously missed that. You've got to go and see it again.
You know, can I just say, go and see it again to see whether there's a Will nudie bit in it? No, not really worth the effort.
Duncan in London says, I went to see Harry Potter last weekend, one of millions of others. I must say I really enjoyed it, despite a few problems, as discussed last week. Ron obviously steals the film in every scene he's in. Not sure about that. Much in the same way Alan Rickman stole the film from under Kevin Costner's nose in Robin Hood. I'm not sure that's in... Certainly Alan Rickman did in... Robin Hood. Anyway, however, I've heard that the next film, number 5, the child actors may be replaced as they're growing up faster than their characters.
No, they couldn't.
Does
do that.
Mark think this is possible? Surely audiences have so much invested in the actors and characters, this can't be done.
I can't imagine that they could do that. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, you know, it's perfectly possible for people in their 20s to play people in their teenage years. It happens all the time. I mean, you know, most of the people you see playing teenagers, certainly in American films anyway, are in their 20s. Anyone who has seen Mrs. Henderson Presents, and I mean, this is really bothering me now because I, you know,
you missed Will Young's Mr. Happy.
No, yeah, but it's a question of did I just not see it? And was I so traumatized by it? But anyway, just email in and let us know. The key thing is you see Bob, but I don't remember seeing, unless he's in a group tableau or something. Anyway, but let me know, because it's going to really make me lose sleep now.
Martin in Portsmouth.
I am going to have to go back.
Dear Simon and Sprout Boy, I've been out at the gym.
I'm
just saying. That's what it says. Dear Simon and Sprout Boy, I've been out at the gym. Have I missed Mark throwing a comprehensive wombat stonker of a hissy fit over that new horror film with the E word in the title? Is there saliva on the studio glass? Has he had to lean on the desk and breathe heavily? Is Joe Sale too frightened to come into the studio again? No, she's just off. I imagine we're talking about The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah, OK. So, number one hit in America, $75 million gross so far. You know, may take more than that. Based albeit loosely, on a true story of Annalisa Michel, who died. Now, she was German, and she died in 1976. She was diagnosed by the church as having been, or by her local church, as having been troubled by demonic spirits. There was a lengthy exorcism, which I think lasted something like 8 months. And after she died, there was a court hearing, as to whether or not the priests involved had been guilty of negligent manslaughter. This case then inspires this movie written and directed by Scott Derrickson, which takes the basic idea of the central character, Emily Rose, who is a very, very troubled young woman who may be schizophrenic or may be possessed by the devil. Her priest is played by Tom Wilkinson. At the beginning of the movie, she dies. It's the very, very beginning of the film, starts with her dying. The movie then plays out in flashback as a courtroom drama in which we have Laura Linney as the defender, Tom Wilkinson as the priest, who have to go to court to demonstrate that he was not negligent. What he was actually trying to do was to help Emily Rose. Let's hear a clip. Now, kind of encapsulated in that clip is what's right and what's wrong with the film. On the one hand, if you're interested in demonic possession and all that sort of stuff, which I am, obviously, it is an interesting case. At least the original case was interesting, and what remains of the original case in the film is interesting. It's a courtroom drama in which they are discussing whether or not a priest was actually negligent in thinking that the way to save this girl was through spiritual guidance rather than through medicine. And that's really what it all comes down to. And on the one hand, there is an interesting story in the middle of that, which is kind of fascinating because the defense attorney, as she said, you know, she's an agnostic, she's not a believer, he's a priest, he obviously believes in what he's done. And what we see is flashbacks to the scenes of the woman either being demonically possessed or being mad. They do this very well. They show you a version of the scene in which she's clearly demonically possessed, and they'll show you another version of the scene in which what she's doing is just behaving in a disturbed way. And that is well pulled off. The problem is that what Scott Derrickson has seemed fit to do is to then throw a whole bunch of completely melodramatic hogwash into the mix, which thoroughly undercuts the sense of an engrossing, intelligent drama. One perfect example is witnesses, recalcitrant witnesses, lurk around in alleyways and then suddenly get knocked down by demonic cars that appear out of... It's like, you don't need to do this. The story itself is interesting enough. Also, you don't have to have people giving completely ludicrous speeches about what they believe and what they don't believe and what they think and this, that and the other. I mean, look, I am very, very in favour of people taking dramatic license, but more melodrama is not necessarily more factually engrossing. And I think the real shame of Emily Rose, there's one great line in it when the defense attorney is examining a witness who's a specialist in possession, and she says, tell me why you think Emily Rose may have been possessed. And the witness is saying, well, some people are very sensitive and some people are, and the prosecution lawyer sticks his hand up and says, objection, Your Honor. And the judge says, on what grounds? He says, well, on grounds of silliness. And you think, actually, that is it. That is my objection to this film, is it has drifted into the territory of silliness, which is a shame, because there's a couple of quite creepy set pieces. If you've seen the trailer, incidentally, the trailer is scarier than the film. But there are a couple of good creepy set pieces. There's a very good performance by Jennifer Carpenter, who plays Emily Rose. Very physical performance. Reminded me, to some extent, of the overlooked performance in Ruby, which was an Exorcist ripoff back in, you know, about 20 years ago now. It's not a very good film, but it's featured a very good performance by the woman who played the possessed girl in that. And it's a very physical performance, but it's increasingly frustrating as the movie decides, in fact, all it wants to do is be a silly Exorcist ripoff, which I have very, very little time for. There is apparently another version of this story in the pipeline, which is called Requiem by a German director, which I think is going to come out next year, which I'm kind of looking forward to. So that may be interesting. But in the end, The exorcism of Emily Rose is flawed. It's overly flawed. There are things that are good in it, but they are all lost in the hogwash.
On the subject of Mrs. Henderson, Andrew in Tooting, Will Young does take part in the stripping off, but is at worst still clad in his underwear and doesn't expose himself to the point that Bob does.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Clearly,
you
Will Young thinks that he does.
Well, you know, I'm sorry.
He didn't make it in.
You do not see Will Young in the buff. Okay? There we go.
Okay.
That's going straight on the poster.
We ought to do
Radio
flight,
5.
Okay. Flight plan. What is it?
Flight plan.
Flight plan.
Flight
plan.
You remember immediately after 9/11 when there was all this stuff about nobody will make action-adventure movies about plane disasters anymore. And then suddenly there's been a whole slew of them. So, I mean, it's like whether it's gags about air rage in anger management or whether it's Red Eye and now Flight Plan, clearly the genre survived. The story here is that Jodie Foster is a young mum. This is a role that she likes doing. A young mum with a young daughter, or a middle-aged mum with a young daughter, who gets on an aeroplane. She's in a state of bereavement because her husband has recently died. Her husband's coffin is in the plane and they're taking the coffin back to their home. She's very tired, very emotional. She falls asleep. She wakes up. Her daughter is gone. Worse still, when she says to the flight attendants, my daughter is gone, they all say, you didn't get on the plane with the daughter. There's no record of her on the on the tickets. Your daughter was never on this plane. You are delusional. Now, for a certain amount of time, you think, oh, this is very interesting. This is very tense. This is very edgy. I mean, yes, it's clearly taking its lead from Red Eye, which I think was a great film and a much more honest genre film. But, you know, Jodie Foster's got a great face. She's got a real commanding presence. I mean, it's no wonder that she is one of the very few actresses who could open a movie simply on a poster which has her face on it. I mean, you think about things like Contact, you think about this, you think about Panic Room. You know, she is a really, really commanding presence.
She is one of the few you would go and you think, OK, well, all the rest of them might be rubbish, but I'll go and see if it's got Jodie Foster.
It's not to do with all the rest of them might be rubbish. It's to do with whether or not they have marquee value. And that's the key. I mean, there are millions of brilliant actresses who cannot open movies because of the way the star system works. But there is a handful of actresses. Sandra Bullock is another one. Jodie Foster, Sigourney Weaver to some extent, I suppose, who can open a movie on the strength of their name. And it is, I mean, it's Demi Moore is another example. It says something about the sexism of Hollywood that there is such a small number of them. Now, for half the movie, you think, great Jodie Foster performance, very good claustrophobic direction, really, really getting the most out of this. And then halfway through the movie, it faces the problem that these movies always do, which is it has to settle for one version or the other. Now, the plot is clearly inspired to some extent by The Lady Vanishes. The setup with Foster and her kid is clearly inspired to some extent by Panic Room. And the whole thing is very, very much derivative of Red Eye, which, because Red Eye was a straightforward genre thriller, it knew what it was.
Just trying to define what a genre thriller is.
Well, a genre thriller means it used to mean something like a B movie. It knows it's a thriller. It knows it's an action movie. It knows it's an erotic thriller. It knows what it is. It has certain rules, and there's a kind of an agreement with the audience about things that it will do and things that it won't do. Roger Corman was the great genre producer. Flight Plan has aspirations above that. It thinks that it's a really, really serious psychological work. And the problem is that halfway through, when they finally have to settle down on one side or the other, in Red Eye, it gets away with it because, hey, it's a Wes Craven thriller. I'm here to have an exciting, fun-packed ride, and that's great. No worries. When it does it in Flight Plan, you go, hang on. No, that doesn't make sense. And there are holes in the plot through which you could fly a jumbo jet. So you end up being cross at the fact that they can't resolve the plot, partly because the first half of the film manages to take itself quite so seriously. So it is a classic example of ha,
Is ha, better than ho-hum?
Yeah, ho-hum bad. Ha, is a game of two
That's
halves.
Good.
And is watch this space.
Movie of the week.
Well,
anytime you like.
Exorcism of Emily Rose, with all its faults.
Mark, thank you. We're back Monday at 1 o'clock. Drive comes next on AM, on digital and online. You're listening to 5 Live.